of the sound is like distant. It's in my head differently. I'm just sort of hungry for those different experiences. Yeah. I'm like omnivorous in that kind of way. One could certainly think of it as a type of hyper hearing. And I would say, you know, you could get really specific there, right? What aspect of the sound are you isolating or drawing attention to? But so much of it is tied into perception as well, right? Because you could go to a chamber meters below the earth where it's super quiet and you'll hear your voice in a way you probably have never heard before. You know, that could be a type of hyper hearing, as you're saying. Or you could be in a weird cave and hear your voice echo in a strange way, right?
Yeah.
It's about like the physical phenomenon of like the how the sound is happening, but also just what level of attention are you able to have to it to sort of filter or let in something different, you know?
Yeah, there's a sort of attunement that comes with ways of hearing and listening. And we're not a bat. We're not a fish. There's so many different ways that other creatures are hearing.
Yeah, yeah. It's a really, I mean, it's a very rich field. There's so much to study and learn within it. I'm no expert on anything, but I would recommend reading the book An Immense World by Ed Yong. And that's where he discusses animal senses. And he's such a great narrator. He's a really great science communicator. And so the way he's able to create a bridge between our understanding of the world and the possibility really of understanding an animal's experience of the world has been really like informative for me. So yeah, I would recommend reading that if you really want to like get into the weeds with understanding how different beings perceive sounds. Yeah.
I kind of like what you said, how different beings perceive sound. Going back to the physicality of sound, but also your relationship to sound and music. You are a self-described untrained musician. How do you interact with instruments and what do you consider an instrument?
Yeah, I love being a self-described untrained musician. It's like no shade, but you said you're not trained. You didn't finish your piano lessons. So instrument, there's so many meanings of the word instrument. We call things instruments that are also sensors, right? Like a stethoscope is an instrument, right? It helps you like listen. It helps you like sense and perceive the world, right? It's not necessarily something that produces sound on its own, but I enjoy that blurring there because I think of sound as a tool for like orienting and disorienting ourselves in the world. And so for me, just to give myself space to play, I'm like, well, anything can be an instrument, but I do have my own desires about like a type of sound quality or musicality that from the object that I'm working with. And certain objects, it makes sense why they become things that we call instruments. For example, wood, right? Different types of wood are going to resonate differently. And I almost think about it as like the voice of an object. When I realized that that sculpture in the park, if you hit it, it had a voice and it was like really ready to sing, right? So different objects have their own like, and materials have their own resonant qualities. And you can collaborate with them. You can work with them, exploit them, whatever, in order to make certain sound events happen, right? Contact mics can make anything an instrument. You just clip a contact mic to it and suddenly you've got something that's producing sounds that are perceivable and that you can manipulate. You know, you can put that through a system, put it through an amplifier, put it through a mixer and manipulate it and play with it. Put that contact mic in your hair, put in some tinsel. I guess you can't put it in water, you know, but, you know, you can work around that and use like a hydrophone. So I really am like anything is an instrument that is helping me understand my world and its materials sonically. That's what I've been playing around with. But there's some hard facts, though. Like, if I want to make something that replicates another instrument, if I want to make a thumb piano, I can be free to make it out of whatever I want. But will it make sounds in a predictable way that are readily perceivable? I don't know, depending on what materials I use, right? So, yeah, there's lots of adjusting that can happen within there to get towards what you really want.
Yeah.
I've just been thinking a lot about, I guess, your influences, Afro-pessimism specifically, which has been on my reading list for the longest time. So this is actually inspiring me to finally sit down and make it a part of, yeah, my own theory, because right now I'm in grad school. And also to just anti-Blackness. And, you know, it makes me think how, like, anti-Blackness operates both in the conscious and subconscious. And I'm curious if sound or using sound as performance can be used as a conduit between the audience and the performer. So oftentimes, you know, I feel like anti-Blackness, a lot of people might not even know that they are operating within a state of anti-Blackness. And so thinking of sound and how it can operate in a frequency that can also inhabit the subconscious, you know, can it be a disruptor of anti-Blackness? Can it be used as a disruptor of that?
Yeah, I mean, there's so many practices that are doing the thing that you're curious about, I would say. Again, to call back to America's musical traditions, right? You know, from spirituals to the blues to rock and roll to like rap music to like, you know, gospel, soul, like all these things. You would think, especially with the blues, where you're literally singing about your troubles living in an anti-Black world, you know, you think that this would maybe disrupt anti-Blackness. But no, the industry uses anti-Black economics to exploit the blues musician, right? You know, like, so I don't want to think of sound as like capable of doing magic or something in that kind of way. I would love it if it were as easy as just like playing a certain tone, like a dog whistle, like tone where like someone's just like going off or is about to do something that they, you prefer that they not do. And it just sort of gives them some pause, right? Like that'd be a fun experiment. And I'm sure there's someone in a lab somewhere that's working on something like that, right? We know that sound impacts behavior. And there's also like the sound of anti-Blackness, not just in speech, right? But there's like an article, it was someone saying like, why is gentrification so quiet or something like that? And it was a quote unquote, like native born and bred New Yorker who knew that a neighborhood was changing when its soundscape changed. And the author kind of explores their own ambivalences about like the sonic changes, because sound is many things. It's also classed, it's racialized. And like, I would say for me, right, like I live in an apartment in Friendship, which is a quaint little neighborhood in Pittsburgh, not too far from here. And my building, generally fairly quiet. And I had a new neighbor that moved in, and she and her family were much louder than my previous neighbors. And I was just kind of like, am I being anti-Black? Because like this person is too loud for me, you know, like, and I can hear all of her conversations. And I mean, part of that's that like we're living this like under renovated apartment with really thin walls, you know, so like we're just in each other's space in that kind of way. But then there's also kind of a comfort too, that like her presence indicated for me that like I don't have to be a certain type of person to live in this building, you know what I mean? So the question that you've presented, it's really deep, you know, it's super deep. A whole book could be written about it. But these are some of the things that come to mind for me about how sound is racialized and how, like, despite the good work that people have been doing for centuries with sound, sound doesn't necessarily automatically change minds and hearts. Sound doesn't happen in a vacuum. and so it's like, what else has happened in a person's life? You may listen to the music, but are you building relationships with people? Do you have a curiosity about the people in your life? Do you have a curiosity about yourself and your own behaviors and the things that you've taken for granted? And maybe you can bond over sound. But yeah, I don't think it's like a magic trick.
I also wanted to ask about Afro-pessimism versus Afro-futurism, and who did these serve in a power structure or system? How do you kind of navigate both of those terms?
I think that's a good question. And honestly, I haven't engaged much with Afro-pessimism with my theoretical hat on in a while, not since writing my graduate thesis. And even then, you know, it's an ongoing conversation, of course. There's a lot of different terms thrown around. It's like Afro-pessimism. There's like Black optimism. There's all these different words. There's like Afro-surrealism, you know, Black quantum futurism. There are all these ways people have been working to understand and share knowledge about the systems that we are under. Yeah, the ways that anti-Blackness occurs, right? I mean, there's even the conversation around like critical race theory, right? Where it's like, hey, actually this stuff is baked into the laws, you know? So yeah, I haven't like engaged with the academy in that way in a while to talk about Afro-pessimism with, in a sense that feels like fresh and current and like I know who the quote unquote players are. But from what I recall, like the conversation being a few years back is some folks being like, we can't just focus on the terrible things that have happened. There has to be more. Honestly, I think it's people being like, what gives me a reason to wake up, you know, tomorrow morning? You know, does Afro-pessimism make me feel excited to wake up and do my day and be creative and make work? For some people, the answer is yes. For some people, it's no, right? Everyone has their own sense-making project. And with like Afrofuturism, okay, well, I don't know who made up the term Afro-pessimism. I don't know if it was Frank Wilderson and his colleagues, but I will tell you that the term Afrofuturism was created by a white scholar, not a Black scholar. And that's interesting, right? I'm forgetting his name. I feel like it's Mark something. It's a term that quickly helps your audience, whoever you're talking to, kind of place you somewhere. But like the destination shouldn't be predetermined by that name, right? Because I could be making Afrofuturist work that still engages with the past, that engages with enslavement and colonialism and empire. I could be doing that work and still be thinking about a future. So yeah, I know that definitely the terms have been put into opposition. And that people may have their like theoretical camps and sort of be sort of figuring it out. Sometimes I'll dip and dabble and sprinkle a little Afrofuturism on my stuff if I just want to just be like, this is what it is, art and technology. Let's go, you know. But I would really like to, yeah, I would really like to find a term that feels like home for me, or just be happy like not having a specific home and just borrowing from these different discourses because they have different things to teach me.
Yeah, so going back to your thesis, in your thesis you speak of or bring up the concept of withness. Mm-hmm. What does working with an audience generate for you? What has surprised you, shocked you, kept you going?
Yeah, thank you for that question. Oh my goodness. Yeah, so I bring that up in the thesis, withness. Sonia Karana, shout out. I brought that up in the thesis because I was really struggling with my relationship to audience. It was this thing of having what felt like incompatible compulsions, whereas like, I want to make work that's performed in front of people, but I don't want to be perceived. So how do I get through this? Like, I'm so scared about like the lack of control I have and being perceived, but like the thing I want to do can only happen with other people. Because I have questions about play. I have questions about how we're socializing. I have questions about how we're making sense of present day events. I have questions about like how we process information in our bodies, right? I want to know more than what's going on in my head. So withness for me has been a way through, and I talked about like clowning as well and like the idea of like sharing breath, right? And that being this sort of like exchange, I don't know if it's always an equitable exchange, but there's an exchange where like I mentioned before, there's a people looking in and be like, I want to play too. Or like, oh, what's going on over there, right? The kids kind of looking in and judging, but also wondering, right? There's something about offering possibilities for other people and therefore offering more possibilities for yourself that comes with acknowledging a withness. I think also it helped me articulate the type of performances I felt less comfortable with, where it felt like a performer was just shutting me out so they could do their compulsion in front of me. And it felt like non-reciprocal in a way, right? And often, you know, that's a feeling one can have as an artist. And yeah, sometimes you do want to see like someone freak out, and be like, wow, I didn't know I could do that. I guess that's possible. And other times it's like, I didn't ask for that. I wanted some mystery, you know? And I would struggle within myself because it's like, is this like my latent Christianity coming out right now? Like, there's a conservatism I'm having right now about what's above board or not. And some people are just doing too much, you know? So what's the difference between that experience where I want to run out of the room and experience that like deeply like shakes me and affects me? And I've been in situations where I'm on the side of, I love this artwork that's really challenging and messed up because it takes us to a place that we normally don't go to. And I remember discussing this work, piece by my friends, Jennifer Kidwell and her collaborator, Scott Shepherd. And I was working on the show, helping out with props and some other things here and there. And I was talking to this Black elder about the show, and she was like, just disgusted with the show. Why would you want to produce an image of that, right? It's almost like the Afro-pessimism, Afro-futurism conversation. Why do you want to dwell on that? Why would you create images like that? I remember kind of being like, yeah, I get why this would upset you, but like, I'm not you. And there's a type of witness that I could have because I knew the performers. I gotten to know them. But even before I got to know them, they were with me in experience that I had had. Sometimes you feel these bodily echoes of a history that you could have actually experienced, or a history that could have been an ancestral experience, or stories you heard from family members or something like that. And when you have a witnessing experience that transports you to that moment and allows you to process it in real time, and the performer does that in a way that's effective, it can be so transformative. So I'm thinking about it, obviously, I'm thinking about it as an audience member and as a performer. And also, I will say that there's ways in which people consume our bodies, period. Like, all, you know, anybody who works, their body's being consumed in some kind of way. But as like an artist, especially in the age of like Instagram, I'm a millennial. I'm not an elder millennial, but, you know, probably 35. And seeing how people use their bodies for their practice by being like cute or interesting on social media. And the body may be literally in the work, but it could also be like what's giving context to the work. All that consumption just was really messing with my head. And also like being in grad school during the Zoom times, you know, hyper perception, hyper surveillance, you know. So yeah, I really had to figure out for myself, how can I be okay with people looking at me? And they're not just looking at me. They're like ideally sharing space with me. And I get to create rules around that. I don't have complete control, but I do get to structure that exchange. And ideally, it feels good. I want performing to feel good. I just want performing to feel good and feel good for the audience. And maybe that means I just don't make work that's very interesting or risky. But like, I want it to be accessible and for there to be so many different ways in for people.
I mean, like, even the act of making an audio-based thesis is a way of making accessible. Because, I mean, communication or conversation. For me, when you shared your thesis, I listened to it in my headphones. And so it was kind of directly pumped into my ears. And like we've talked about, there's kind of this sound canceling that happens. So there was nothing else but you kind of being pumped in. And it was a rather intense experience to kind of sit, close my eyes, listen, and consume your thoughts and your ideas, and really exciting. So,
yeah, thank you. Thank you for describing that. I'm past the point of feeling like stressed out when someone says that they listen to it. I'm like, oh, but right. That's a way of practicing witness where like you're not seeing my body because of how I recorded it kind of accidentally. Like it's like, okay, we're sharing. Yeah, there's like this is a bodily awareness that's being shared, which is cool. Thank you.
I mean, something that has also kind of come up in this conversation that was touched on by other classmates is this text by Audre Lorde that you quote, which is about the erotics of the audience and the uses of the erotic and the erotics as a bridge. One of our classmates wanted to ask, what are some of your everyday erotics?
Let's see. I will say that A couple weeks ago, I worked on an install at the Science Center, and it was very physical. You know, I was being so, I was being like Butch Barbie, like so buff, and I loved it after a period of being, you know, very sedentary during the winter. So it was like, I'm hauling around huge movable walls on a pallet jack. I am like using my hands to put things up. I'm like running cable. I'm figuring out what tools I need to like accomplish something. I learned how to safely use a scissor lift. And I was really feeling like in my body. And because of the work schedule, like I had a particular routine, be there at 8. So we'd have our first break at 10, then have our break at 12, and then break at 3. And it put me into this kind of routine and awareness of myself. And I really enjoy being myself when I just feel that feeling of competence and know-how. The various trials and error that I've had like have led to something, you know? And yeah, that feels good. Growing season is coming back. Pittsburgh's frost hopefully will end by mid-April, and I'll have my hands in the dirt again. And I'll be nurturing some plants and figuring it out with other people. And like having plant time is a kind of erotics for me. Even setting up my little balcony garden, which always gets messed with by either squirrels or maintenance workers at my building. Like everybody's messing with my stuff. But when it's really cute, you know, there's like a neighborhood cat that comes and just like, wow, like, you know, like just sits there. I sit there in my robe, catching the breeze. I'll watch like birds sort of like come around and do their little bird thing. I'll notice who's blooming or which vines are sort of going. Noticing how like, for example, I grow gourd plants and they're a very like musky plant. I don't know. Maybe there's like something to bottle up and put in like a cologne mix or something, but like it's a very specific scent. And they're also super hairy. They're just covered in what we would say like is peach fuzz. I'm a hairy person. I'm like, you know, I've come back around to like being more okay with it, but it always was like an issue for me. And thinking about like my own desirability, you know, as a person, like, oh, I got too much hair. And my mom telling me that growing up in Liberia, having like leg hair was hot, you know, like people be like, ooh, look at that girl. Her legs are hairy. And I'm like, wrong place, wrong time. Like, but yeah, seeing that my gourd plants are just as fuzzy as me, you know, that feels like a type of erotics too, where I feel like connected and rooted and I want to wake up the next day. But I'll also have a disclaimer there that like it's not always easy to get to set aside the time. It's like I almost have this amnesia about things that feel good. And I think I just literally need a list of things that feel good. That I need to like look at and just be like, what am I doing on this list? I don't know why I'm like this, but when I remember that these are things that bring me pleasure, that's when I'm living a good life.
That's awesome. This has been such a great, amazing conversation. Unfortunately, we're at towards the end, but we do have one final question.
Okay.
Our final question is, what brings you deep joy?
Deep joy. Well, I love a good improv. When the thing happens, and we're just all vibing and flowing. People know when to pull back and when to pull forward, when to give space, how to do call and response with each other. Oh my gosh, like I'm getting a head tingle right now thinking about it. I got to be in this improvised performance at the space upstairs, right above the Center for Creative Reuse. It's right above there. It's like a warehouse space that has a resident dance group, that dance company that's there. I think the current one's called like the Pillow Project. Anyway, some folks from the improv group that I usually go to were performing and I was invited to join. We were essentially collaborating with this group called How Things Are Made. And the setup was there'd be like four of us improvising with our various instruments connected to mics or whatever. And then the dudes from How Things Are Made would be processing all of our signals, right? So like they have the mixers and the various computers routing sound around. And we had a score inspired by John Cage, actually, where you could see like what seconds or minutes you were going to be like playing your instrument and when you were to fall back. So there could be some minutes where you're just like falling back and just getting to like tap in and to see what people are doing around you, right? And it was like pure, uncut, fill in the blank. It was such an ecstatic experience. And I just was like, I had a high for the next day, just feeling that level of connection and freedom with other performers. My partner was in the audience. I was like, yeah, check me out, baby. Like, I'm doing the thing, you know? I felt good in my body. I just felt so embodied and grounded and present. And so, yeah, that brought me like deep joy, and it had the erotics component in it as well. And yeah, that was real good. That was really, really good.
Awesome. Well,
amazing. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. Thank you for tuning in to Is Sound a Language?
Thanks, y'all. Thanks for inviting me. Shout out to Ginger for being a sibling in sound. Looking forward to experimenting with you more and playing with you more.
open. Yes, I'm chasing. Slick complacent. Maybe don't be so basic, but I still taste it. I need a break.
Take a break, let me break you off, let me I take a piece. Yup, take it off in my face. Sheesh, now the race is on. Now the race is on. Take a drink, please. Let me break it off. Let me take a piece. Yup, take it off in my face. Sheesh, now the race is on. Now the race is on.
sick, but I still taste it. I need a breath to get over you. I need a smile. Construct with different people. It's not even love, it's not us, it's self. Let me fill your cup, I'll even refill. Take a break, please. Let me break you off, let me take a piece. Yup, take it off in my face, sheesh. Now the race is on. Now the race is on. Take a break, please. Let me break you off, let me take a piece. Yup, take it off in my face, sheesh. Now the race is on. Now the race is on. Thank you.
do ya? Like I usually can. But it's just something about the things you do to me. You keep me places I know I ain't supposed to be. Yes, I'm chasing, slick, I'm facing. Maybe don't be so basic, but I still taste it. I need a breath to get over you. I need a smile.
Construct with different people. It's lacerations on to the break of peace. Let me break you off, let me take it easy. And you're taking off in my face, cheese. Lacerations on, lacerations on.
I'm still taste it. I need a breath to get hold of you. I need the sky. Construct with different people. It's not even love, it's not us, it's them. Let me fill your cup, I'll even refill. Take a break, please. Let me break you off, let me take these. Yup, take it off in my face, sheesh. Now the race is on. Now the race is on. Take a break, please. Let me break you off, let me take these. Yup, take it off in my face, sheesh. Now the race is on. Now the race is on.
It's just insane. We have the most insane system of health insurance on the planet. We're the only industrialized country, the only developed country that in which the citizens of the country can go bankrupt or lose their homes or die because they don't have coverage or they get their policies canceled.
There are many, many ways in which a society is gagged. One is gagging by law. One is gagging by outlaws. That is the extra-legal, illegal, violent means of gagging that take place. Third is the gagging by corporate media. Then there is the fourth, that is the gagging that comes with big money and